Om Gyanati Mirandhasya Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Shrestham Manum Api Shachiputra Matra Swarupam Rupam Tasya Gajamurupurim Maturim Goshtavartim Radha Kundam Girivaramaho Radhika Matavasham Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Shri Gurum Tandatos. Bande Hum Shri Guru Shri Yatav Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagarjatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajiva Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Taitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishaka Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Okay, fire away. I'm at your disposal. I'm your servant. Not very good servant, but...
Oh, Maharaj, thank you very much, first of all, for joining today, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. It's been my very fond aspiration to have your association. I started the Monks podcast about 1.5 years ago, and since the early days of my Krishna consciousness, I was always very inspired by your thought-provoking and, of course, sometimes provoking classes. One of the reasons I started the Monks podcast was that we often, on the Vyasasan, we can certain topics are spoken, but there are many other topics that are important for devotees' discussion, for understanding. And those topics could be discussed over here. So, you know, I especially have appreciated many of your books. In fact, you are one of my inspirations to actually start writing up as a serious service.
You've done a lot of writing.
Yeah, I tried to do some things by Krishna's mercy. And your Bhakti Siddhanta Vaibhav was an immense inspiration for me to three things, actually, among many that, first of all, just the sheer amount of effort you had put in comprehensively documenting Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur's life, also the level of vocabulary and scholarship and analysis that had gone into that book, and the broadening of the understanding of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, that not just in terms of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Chaitanya Lila, but in terms of recent history. So I found that book very, very illuminating personally. And I also had the fortune to be of some service to you in some of your books, especially the Balaram book. And
which is still in the womb. It's Balaram's still in the womb. It's a long pregnancy.
It's beautifully put.
There was a miscarriage and it entered the womb of Kishore Prabhu, he's attached to Balaram and won't let him go.
Okay.
You don't understand. It's cryptic language.
No, but it's a quick, I mean, the very sharp and pertinent metaphor of long pregnancy and miscarriage. It's brilliant correlation.
Because Balaram, he went from the womb of Devaki to Rohini by apparent miscarriage, and you know.
Yes, Maharaj, yeah, that's true.
About this point of broadening the perspective about the Sampradaya, there's still huge amount of work to do on that. Some devotee scholars are doing that, as you know, no doubt you're connected with the academic side of ISKCON.
Yes, ma'am.
And they're mostly looking at the history and I just saw there's one of your godbrothers at Oxford brought out a thesis on the political undercurrents at the time of Baladev Vidyabhushan and how that affected, how it appeared, I haven't read it, but how it appeared to have affected their philosophy or their presentation of Krishna consciousness, which is quite amazing if you think about it. The social ramification. Well, that's what we're going to talk about. But another thing, really, just like Srila Prabhupada said, if you want to know me, read my books. So really, to understand the previous acharyas, you really have to go deeply into their teachings.
Yes, Maharaj.
For that, you need to know Sanskrit very well, and Nyaya, Mimamsa, and so many things. And of course, for 99.99% of us, everything we need to know is in Srila Prabhupada's books.
Yes, ma'am.
Anyway, please go on, because we didn't even get started yet. But yes, we could say so many things even before we get started. Yeah, so, please.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. So I thought that today we could discuss on this topic of continuity and change within the tradition, because you have studied Prabhupada very deeply. You have written several books on Jai Prabhupada and other books about and appreciating Prabhupada, speaking strongly in Prabhupada's service. And then you have written also about Bhakti Sanskrit Thakur. So
I'm also working, just to interrupt you, which I shouldn't do, but I'm doing it. I'm also working on a big book. It'll be about 1,000 pages, about just an overview of everything Srila Prabhupada did and how he did it. And so that's quite a big thing. That's going to be bigger than all the works I've done on Srila Prabhupada so far, all of them put together.
Oh, is this the book on the mood and mission of Srila Prabhupada that discussed?
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I'll discuss it with you some more after we've finished this talk.
Yes, ma'am.
Because it's going along, but slowly. Anyway, we can discuss that afterwards. But that's going to be a very important book.
Yes, Maharaj.
So, yeah.
So, in one sense, because these two are the most prominent recent acharyas we have, Srila Prabhupada and Bhakti Sanskrit Thakur. So, the dynamism of the how the tradition works, I thought we could discuss that based on looking at their teachings and their presentation of Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
At one level, Prabhupada did say that, I'm simply like a postman. I didn't change anything. I just spoke my spiritual master's message. And at the same time, Prabhupada encountered a very different socio-cultural reality, especially in the West. So he did have to adapt to present the thing. So I have thought of maybe 4 or 5 points where there are seeming differences in Prabhupada's approach or emphasis. So we could take them one by one and discuss the dynamism of continuity and change in the Gaudiya tradition with a focus on Prabhupada and Bhakti Sanskrit Thakur.
Okay. Yeah, definitely it's okay. Before we get into discussing that, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the importance of this topic. It can be taken simply as an intellectual exercise, and there are scholars who do that, not only in the religious field. They study the, for instance, in Marxism, the different strands of Marxism. And it is possible to be a scholar of religion and not actually believe or be committed, but just you just study it, just like some people study butterflies and some people study atomic reactions and some people study religionists, and they just study it, but they're not committed to it. But for us, it's important to see about this preservation and continuity, because we are in the process.
Yes,
when we say we are in the parampara, I just read something that Jayadvaita Maharaj quoted from Kripa Moy Prabhu, saying that about Prabhupada disciples, it's very important that he said we don't realize that others are looking at us, and what we do will set for future generations how they understand Prabhupada, what we do, how we interpret it. So it is important. We're engaged in something which is of such tremendous importance. It's difficult for us to gauge how important what we're doing. The Supreme Personality of Godhead comes down as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and showers his mercy on the world. And here we all are. And we are the ones, for better or for worse, who are carrying that forward. And we have our massive acharyas. We're talking here particularly about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and our own Srila Prabhupada. Just massive figures who literally altered the course of religious history and made religious history. And we are the ones who are in charge with carrying that message forward. And just like you're saying, that the Srila Prabhupada faced a different socio-cultural milieu than that of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Well, so do we, because the world is changing so much all the time. Of course, there's always birth, death, old age, and disease. But in the Western world, the influence of feminism has tremendously changed people's outlook. And even men, I would say nowadays, are much more, just by cultural pressure, they have to be very sensitive and all this kind of thing. Touchy-feely, yes, that's one way of putting it. Or microaggression is another.
Yeah, that is true.
So the way Srila Prabhupada preached was so strong. And it was quite amazing that he largely got away with it even at that time. I mean, we didn't find people, just like he went on TV and this and that, and he was very forthright. But we do find a very different way. So that's a big question. I mean, that's a major question facing our movement, isn't it? Gender issues. I'm getting questions from America. How do we deal with people who are serious about Krishna conscious, but they're transgender?
Yes.
It's something outside of my experience. The world has, there are significant changes in the world, and people want to know about this, right?
What's your
attitude towards transgender people?
Yeah, in fact.
And go on.
So in fact, for many, especially liberal-minded people, the attitude toward these kind of issues is like a litmus test for them. How they decide what kind of organization you are.
Yeah.
So that becomes very problematic. So in one sense, our discussion is not just about the past. From the past, we want to get some guidelines to deal with the present and the future.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. That's why this discussion, it's not just some kind of academic discussion between us, but we have to carry that forward into the present and into the future. But another thing is that we, without any insult to yourself, but we, you and I and so many others, it's absolutely safe to say we're just not on the level of Srila Prabhupada or Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur.
Of course.
And even Prabhupada himself said, in America, I was experimenting. He was trying things out. And one example we can see of that, he got couples married and just said, okay, you marry overnight. He said, tomorrow you're going to marry this one. Tomorrow you're going to marry this one. And he expected it to work out on the basis of Krishna consciousness, but it didn't.
Yeah.
So if even Srila Prabhupada was experimenting, what's our position? On the one hand, we're talking about preserving the principle. Preserving the essence. But and like you said, people, the litmus test, they won't even give us the time of day. We're just a closed book to them if they think that we don't accept their ideas of gender equality or transgenderism and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But our philosophical teachings, look at the books of Srila Prabhupada, which we're distributing. They're not. They disagree with that very strongly. So these are real issues, and they're not easy ones.
Yes,
but at the same time, we have great acharyas, and we have ourselves, and we have the mandate to carry it on. So we can simply pray. We can look at their example and try to understand. That's another thing. It's very difficult to understand, actually, everything that they did and why they did it. Vaishnavera Kriya Mudra Vigeha Nabhujoy. So that's another thing.
Yes, ma'am.
I must say, now I'm making, for the last few years, what could be called a deep study of Srila Prabhupada and what he did and everything. Some things I find... That I would have just accepted. It's, you could say, intellectually, some things I don't understand when I start to go deeper. So there we go.
So you are saying as you study more, some things which would have been, which were acceptable earlier are there is
well, when I
now?
When I think about it, I'll just give you one example. He's not very well known in our movement nowadays. Siddha Swarupananda.
Yes.
He was, for years and years, Srila Prabhupada, you could say, tolerated him and encouraged him, while the rest of Srila Prabhupada's disciples were very strongly against Siddha Swarupananda. He was causing a lot of trouble to what you might call the regular ISKCON, but Prabhupada went on encouraging him. But then it, sometimes to Siddha Swarupananda's face, and definitely to Burijan Prabhu, he was very strong in condemning him, but he went on encouraging him. On the other hand, there were Kanu Priya and Jamadagni in Los Angeles who asked Srila Prabhupada some very pointed questions, but very pertinent questions. Just like, you must have seen this conversation. They were asking questions like, well, how do we explain that Maharaj Ugrasena had 7 billion bodyguards, which is more than the population of the world at the time?
Yeah.
It seems, how do you explain? And it seems to me like a very pertinent question. But Prabhupada didn't want to deal with, he didn't want to deal with them. It seems to me because he perceived that they were somewhat defiant of him. But
yeah, and so in that conversation, yeah, Prabhupada also seems to consider that issue not very consequential. He says that among thousands of verses of the Bhagavatam, why focus on that particular thing, especially when dealing with scholars? So,
but they said that well, we're giving these books to intelligent people. They're going to ask us these questions. What do we say? Yeah. And it seems to me to be a very pertinent question. But Srila Prabhupada. And then they also said that so-and-so approached me homosexually. And Prabhupada also just, he just seemed a bit disturbed by it, but he just also just brushed that aside, so to speak. He just didn't, he didn't want to deal with them. And of course, Srila Prabhupada has the full prerogative to do that. And it seems he didn't like their attitude in asking. But at the same time, the questions are very pertinent. The questions themselves are very pertinent.
Yes.
So like that.
Yes, Maharaj, that is true. So, you know, before we wade into territory that is like very controversial in today's terms, if we just look back at Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, so broadly, people have asked, some devotees and devotee academics and even some academic scholars have asked me these questions about how do we reconcile some differences in Prabhupada's focus, strategy or style as compared to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's. So one explanation, of course, is the different circumstance. Now, one thing which seems very striking is Prabhupada's vocabulary was much more accessible than Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's vocabulary. And it also, to some extent, at least it seems that in the early BTG articles, Prabhupada used a little more vocabulary that was similar to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's. But later on, he started using a little, or at least in his purports and many of his other books, the vocabulary seems to be more accessible. So do you have any idea with, did you notice this or how do you see this difference in vocabulary basically?
Okay. Before we're getting into the meat, you could say, of the discussion now. But if you agree, I'll read out, I have 3 pages from my Mood and Mission book.
Okay, please, Maharaj.
Okay, I'm going to read a chapter called Different and Non-Different from His Guru. It'll take about 10 minutes, I guess, to read.
Okay.
And you can interrupt me at any time. In 1958, Abhay Charanaravinda Das described his spiritual master in words that later became undeniably applicable to himself also. So please listen to this, understanding that it's Srila Prabhupada describing his own guru, but the same words can be used to describe Srila Prabhupada also. So Srila Prabhupada wrote, "You preached the pure philosophy of Lord Gauranga in such a way that intelligent persons could understand. And you showed such great concern, O Master, in convincing all your adversaries. Lord Gauranga used many tricks just to engage the conditioned souls in devotional service. That's very relevant to our whole discussion today, isn't it?
Yes, that's true.
Lord Gauranga used many tricks just to engage the conditioned souls in devotional service, and you have also understood how to use all those tricks perfectly well. You understood time, place, and circumstance and utilized everything as a strategy for preaching. End of the quote. In 1976, Srila Prabhupada had the logo of the Gauriya Mat, originally designed by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, painted on both pillars of the main entrance gate at ISKCON's world headquarters in Mayapur, which is, of course, the place where there are so many Gauriya Mats. Actually, at that time, there was only the Sri Chaitanya Mat, Advaita Bhavan, Yoga Pit, Madhav Maharaj's Mat, and Goswami Maharaj's Mat. But later, so many others came.
Okay.
Anyway, Prabhupada had the logo of the, have you seen it, the gate of Mayapur? They have on both sides the logo of the Gauriya Mat. Thus, asserting his allegiance to the vision and core concepts of Saraswati Thakur, notwithstanding the several differences in externals that he necessarily instituted in order to make possible the fulfillment of Saraswati Thakur's mission, the establishment of Krishna consciousness worldwide. Like his own guru, Srila Prabhupada was being impelled by intense compassion for the conditioned souls, an aggressive and uncompromising preacher of the absolute truth. So that idea of compassion and aggression normally are not, they're not considered to go together. And like his guru, Srila Prabhupada was self-reliant, strong-minded, and with huge plans, yet also fully dependent upon and a surrendered follower of his guru. Like his guru Dev, Srila Prabhupada started his mission alone, going against the current of the time, with no help and facing opposition even from other Vaishnavas. Only by unshakable conviction, tenacity, and power of devotion were both gradually able to gather followers and do something unexpected, unimagined, and magnificent for establishing Krishna's glories in the world. In unprecedentedly bringing Krishna consciousness to non-Hindus, Srila Prabhupada kept his teachings well grounded in the principles and doctrines of his predecessors in the Gauriya Vaishnav tradition. Srila Prabhupada charted the course that all seminal religious teachers must negotiate, that between fidelity to a tradition and relevance to a time and place, with consideration of the mentality and aptitude of those he ministered to. That paragraph is taken from something that my godbrother Pradyumna Prabhu wrote. Very important observation. Okay, continuing what I wrote. There is no reason that acharyas cannot have different outlooks, approaches, and personalities. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was known to be very strict and grave. Yet Srila Prabhupada, while not lacking these qualities, was more accommodating and fun-loving, quote-unquote.
Okay.
Under Srila Prabhupada, and then there's a whole section I have about how Srila Prabhupada made Krishna consciousness fun for the newcomers. That's another chapter.
Yes,
but at the same time, the fun it was bringing people into the actual bliss of the spiritual world, spiritual fun.
So now, when Prabhupada said, you have mentioned this point that there is no reason why one acharya cannot be different from another acharya in some things.
And one different outlooks, approaches, and personalities. Yeah.
Yes. So now personality, of course, we understand is intrinsic to every individual. Now when Prabhupada said, I didn't change anything. So how do we understand that? What did he mean? Was he implicitly referring to like essentials I haven't changed?
Yeah, the message is unchanged.
Okay.
The spiritual message. Certain outlooks on social issues may be different. We see that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he, like most of the, or from what I understand, most of the Bhadralok of Calcutta at that time was against child marriage, although he himself had child, he was married as a child, as he describes, and certain other social issues which came to pass, widow remarriage, and but child marriage, Srila Prabhupada was in favor of it, at least marriage at a very young age. So different outlook on social issues.
Okay. So when we say that unchanging, what it means is that the essential message is not changed. And in one sense, by looking at what are the differences, say, between what Prabhupada has done and Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur has done, or what you can say Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur did, we can also, that can help us get a sense of what is the prince, what is the core that is meant to be kept unchanged, what are the principles, and then what has been changed, that itself we can see is a indication of something which is a contextual social issue that is changeable. Say, for example, say position on issue like widow remarriage or like child marriage. The fact that two acharyas have had different positions on that issue indicates that this itself is not a central issue to our philosophy. And then that can be, the position can be adjusted accordingly. I don't want to go into the issue specifically.
Okay.
I try to understand the principle here. Like, there are spiritual teachings and there are social application of the spiritual teachings. So the social applications may vary. So would that be a domain for relevance and fidelity, roughly speaking?
Well, here I want to bring up a point that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the pioneer of the program for bringing Krishna consciousness to the Western world. That's written in the 1972 edition of the Bhagavad Gita as it is, the first Macmillan edition. There's a picture of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the pioneer of the program to bring Krishna consciousness to the West. Yes. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur came next, and our own Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, he actually did bring it to the West. Srila Prabhupada is the founder Acharya of ISKCON. And therefore, I feel, sorry, I shouldn't say I feel, because Prabhupada, he wanted everything very definite, but we do, we have a society in which there are different opinions about what it means to follow Srila Prabhupada. So I have to say that, I have to put it in a relativistic way, that Srila Prabhupada had a very specific vision for how he wanted Krishna consciousness to unfold in the future. And that's a lot about what the book I'm writing is about. I'm trying to write it just showing what Prabhupada wanted and not insert myself there. But he did foresee a world civilization based on Varnashram Dharma. So when we're talking about social adjustments, that we have to see to adjust to the present situation, but at the same time, keeping Prabhupada's vision of, it's not just that we want to get people to chant Hare Krishna, but we also want to establish on Srila Prabhupada's order a revival of Varnashram Dharma to make it easier for people to live in Krishna consciousness. That's a very big topic, which I have discussed to some extent in the book that I'm writing. So we could say that, well, we just get people to chant Hare Krishna and follow four regulated principles. But Srila Prabhupada had also, and the social issues we can adjust here and there, but Srila Prabhupada had a very definite social program. How we get from here to there, that we can discuss. But first of all, we should see where we're going. It's not just that we're reacting to society. Okay, there's gender issues. Okay, how are we going to react to that? And then there's some other issues come up. How are we going to react to that? But we should have our own clear direction of where we're going socially, which is establishing Varnashram Dharma.
Okay. So if I understand right, what you are saying, Maharaj, is that because Prabhupada is our founder Acharya, even his statements about social issues have a certain significant importance for us. And when he wanted to spread Krishna consciousness, it was not, we could say, just a transcendental program, but also a particular social program that he wanted by which to spread Krishna consciousness.
He did want to establish Varnashram Dharma. That was his social vision, and we should see that as his social vision. And that's not divorced from transcendental Krishna consciousness. It's the social system which helps people to be Krishna conscious. And Srila Prabhupada had this idea, as you know, even before he came to the West. He was very, the early Bhakti God said that he was talking about this. And it seems there was considerable discussion about this in intellectual circles shaping the new India, because from 1947, just suddenly there'd been, for decades, they'd be saying that they want free India, and all it happened quite quickly. They didn't have much time to prepare for it. It happened suddenly that India was independent. The British said, okay, you're going to be independent. After the war, a new government was voted in, the Labour government in Britain. They said, okay, India, be independent. And they speeded it up, and it just, boom, it happened very quickly. But there was a lot of discussion about various, you know very well that Ambedkar, especially talking about caste issues and all this.
That's true, yeah.
But it seems from what little I've studied, and I haven't gone into this deeply, that even Ambedkar himself and Mahatma Gandhi, they weren't against the concept of what we would call the Varnashram Dharma. And at that time in India, of course, in many ways, it worked. In India at that time, even in the villages, well, even in the town, and it's still there. There's the expert artisan community who they know how to, each one, the potter knows how to make pots, the carpenter knows how to make wooden utensils on so many things. And the kayasthas, that's what they're called in Bengal, and Karans in North India, they're expert administrators. And to a certain extent, it worked. But there was this unnecessary discrimination, which Ambedkar was obviously, he, as is well known, he was very disturbed by that. He didn't become a Buddhist overnight. He was trying to work within the
framework of Hinduism.
For a long time,
he tried that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he wasn't against the idea, but I mean, he thought, well, Buddha, he kicked it out. I'll join the Buddhists. So Srila Prabhupada was talking about Varnashram, but he was making the point, and he wasn't the first to do so, either from the spiritual side, either from the religious, it's difficult because in India, the religious and the secular have always been so mixed. And we don't know that now because we're living in 21st century secular India, where it seems as if the secular and the religious are different, although it wasn't until recently. But there were people whose main interest was social. And again, I can give the example of Ambedkar and Gandhi and many others also, who were not against, who were talking about Varnashram and the caste system, and were saying that it's got to be quality-based and not birth-based. So it wasn't only Srila Prabhupada who was saying this. And of course, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was saying that India has to revive its real Varnashram system, and then India can become very strong and lead the world spiritually. So it was a very, it was a big topic of discussion even before Srila Prabhupada came to the West. But the amazing thing was that he wanted to implement that even in the West. That's really revolutionary, especially considering in the West there's so much egalitarian minded.
Yes, Maharaj. Varnashram itself is a huge subject. It's a huge subject. Yeah. And
why don't we have another talk some other time about
that? Yes, Maharaj, we could discuss that definitely. So Now,
how do we get there?
Yeah, we were talking about trying to understand whether we could understand what are the principles and what are the details based on, say, Prabhupada's social positions. So you said that we have to be a little cautious about that, because Prabhupada also did focus on social issues quite strongly. I think in one of our discussions earlier, several years ago, you had mentioned that Prabhupada was among the first acharyas to integrate social commentary in his scriptural commentaries. His scriptural commentaries are not just scriptural explication, but he addresses social issues elaborately. So if we look at Prabhupada and we look at Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, so you were reading your the extract from your book, and I was making this point that relevance and fidelity, if those two things are to be balanced. So are there certain things which we can see as significant differences between Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, which can give us some guidelines for principles or some guidelines for how to, or what is adjustable and what is not adjustable? Because if we say that Prabhupada's social policy is instantiated or is made in stone, then that almost becomes like a diversion from the tradition, because most of the adaptation will come in social issues only. So that means the dynamism of fidelity and relevance, in one sense, after Srila Prabhupada becomes frozen to zero relevance and absolute fidelity. Because we are not going to change the scripture. We are not going to ever say that Krishna is not God and Shiva is God. So the most of the relevance will be with respect to social issues. And if we say that Prabhupada's social policy is what is going to be forever for ISKCON, then that means basically there is no room for adaptation at all. And isn't that itself a difference from the way the tradition has operated
For centuries? But I didn't say that, though.
Okay.
I didn't say I said that we have to keep Srila Prabhupada's social vision.
Okay.
And work to, but at the same time see where we are and how to get there. We might have to go like this. Can you see me on the screen? We might have to go like this rather than like this. I write in the introduction, I wrote that to this book, I wrote that we have to keep Srila Prabhupada's instructions as our guidelines, and at the same time not freeze the movement in time.
Okay.
So it is a big discussion, yeah.
Yeah. Because in one sense, for
another thing is that we can sit here discussing like we're doing, and it is of relevance that we discuss such things, of course. But at the same time, there are so many devotees who are out there doing things, not saying that you're not doing anything, which in their own way, they are representing Prabhupada as they see, and they are setting the tone of the Krishna conscious movement. They're influencing it. I'll give one example. It's controversial. Sorry. Mahavishnu Maharaj, my godbrother, he's over 70 years old. He goes out chanting Harinam in public, which is great, regularly. But he has a hat which is considered zany by some, although it has the changing bodies exhibit on it. Yeah, and he wears fluorescent green clogs, and it's a bit zany. And you might say, well, you shouldn't do that. Sannyasi shouldn't do that. I'm not going to comment on that here now. But I'm just saying that you can say this should be done, this shouldn't be done. But in the meantime, people are going out into the world and doing things, and they are representing Prabhupada to others. And it's happening. It's just like there was Christ, and we have his teaching. We think we have his teachings, and then the church was formed, and then another church was formed, and then another church was formed, and the people just, we can say it should be like this, but then at some point in time, someone says, to hell with you, I'm going to start my own church. And they represent Christ to others. So it's not just a matter of intellectually trying to understand it, but what people do also very much influences our approach to Krishna consciousness. And I mentioned that also, the tremendous influence of feminism. I would say that's a big
difference. We take one point at a time, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. This is to illustrate that point.
Yeah.
More. I'm not going to talk about feminism per se, but yeah. I'm just going to say that we, you and I, maybe you came a little later to Krishna consciousness, the way we deal with others in Krishna consciousness is also influenced, I would say, by the whole world. The Western world is very much influenced by being very sensitive to others. Maybe that's a good thing. Probably it is to some extent. But I'm just saying that in the early days, we were probably far too rough, but we were very direct in our dealings.
Yes.
And it could be tough, but nowadays we're very careful how we deal with others. And I would say that that's a reaction, or we're just influenced by the way the whole social milieu is. We are, whether we know it or not,
okay,
influenced by it. Okay, that's a lot of stuff. Over to you.
Thank you, Arash. So I appreciate this point that ultimately any tradition is shaped by people who are actually living it. So there are different people who will live it in different ways, and people will associate that with the tradition. I don't think ever in the tradition there was a possibility to like police or control things like that. Because after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu departed, the Goswamis were in Vrindavan, and then there were some followers in Bengal, some followers in Orissa. So even
disagree.
Let me just complete.
Disagree. This. I disagree. Anyway, go on.
Okay. So the kirtan styles that evolved were slightly different. And there was a broad understanding. My point is that did it ever happen in the Gaudiya tradition or even in the broad Vedic tradition? India itself is so big that somebody could actually monitor and police exactly who is doing what where. So Prabhupada talked about Falena Parichayate, that in fact, as you said, Prabhupada was opposed by Bhaktisanswami Thakur, many of his god brothers when he tried to preach. And Bhaktisanswami Thakur was opposed by some of the followers of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was opposed by many of those who were considered Gaudiya Vaishnavas at their time, the Gaudiya Vaishnava orthodoxy at that time. So it is to some extent different, like Prabhupada talked about experimenting, that different devotees will try different things, and some things will work in terms of attracting people to core Krishna consciousness. Some may not work. So is it possible in advance to actually mandate that this should not be done? Are there any precedents to that in the tradition itself?
Well, we can go back to Rup Kaviraj, was rejected. That was very, very early in the Sampradaya. I mean, even you're saying in the Vedic tradition, there's no policing, but Buddhism was rejected. Jainism was rejected as being non-Vedic. In the Mahabharata, we have, who was that? There was... there were two instances. There was one where one rishi, he preached atheism to Yudhishthira. Who was that? I can't remember his name.
There's
and then
Jabali
he said,
in the Ramayana, Jabali in the Ramayana, in the Mahabharata.
And then afterwards, Krishna rebuked him. And afterwards he said, no, I was just doing it for a purpose. And there was another one, whose name I don't remember, who was just speaking outright atheism, and he was rejected by everyone. Atheism in the sense of being against the teachings, accepting the Vedas. Mm. There was one saying there's no karma, when you die, it's all over.
Yeah.
Like this. I don't remember exactly. So that always has, there's always been a sense of orthodoxy, of what is right and what is wrong. Rup Kaviraj, like I said, I gave the example of Rup Kaviraj was rejected.
No, I think these are, sorry to interrupt you, these are like Buddhism and Jainism, they are in to some extent, they themselves define themselves in contradiction to the Vedic tradition. So whether the Vedic tradition rejected them or not, they themselves define themselves differently. But
that's
Rupa
good,
Kaviraj,
yeah.
Again, I think the issue goes to, I'm not saying that there can be no moral policing or no sort of jurisdiction or regulation. But my point is that if as a movement, we start, you earlier talked about the word microaggression, but the other opposite could be microcontrol. Because we cannot microcontrol our members. Maybe it was possible when everybody was living in the temples, but now we are largely a congregation-based movement. So to some extent, if through discussions like these, some broad principles are understood, then future generations of devotees, they can adopt those principles. Because in general, in our movement, I don't know, as we are spreading, how much control we can ever have on anyone. Especially when people are having their own lives and their own careers and they're not really living in temples. So rather than sort of defining a path, this is the path to go. If we can help people develop their inner compass, then they will know the direction to go in. I'm not saying we don't have a path, but the fact that we are ourselves in an uncharted territory now, and in many ways, the world has changed as compared to few decades ago. What to speak a few centuries ago. So how much is it possible to clearly define this is what Prabhupada wanted and anything different from this is wrong, because over that itself we will end up having debates. So if you could give broad principles rather than specifics, wouldn't that...
Well, what it'll come down to is as it has throughout the generations in all Vedic and even Buddhist sampradayas is Guru Vachan. Okay. Guru says this is how we understand Prabhupada, and those who want, they follow, and those who don't, they prefer someone else's interpretation. That's how I see it's going to come down practically. I think it's going to be very, very, as time goes on, it's going to be more and more difficult to try to impose some orthopraxis on the whole of ISKCON, as you say.
Yeah.
But Guru Vachan should be enough.
So by here, Guru Vachan, you are referring to Srila Prabhupada's words or the Vachan?
No, I know. I'm saying Guru. Individual gurus will say, this is how we're following Srila Prabhupada.
Okay.
Yeah. And it may be different to others.
Yes.
I'm talking about orthopraxis. I'm just reviewing a book that Jayadvaita Maharaj asked me to go through on kirtan standards, and that Prabhupada clearly gave, but it seems impossible to me that we can ever get back to that.
Yes.
Unless we have a sea change within the whole movement about what the kirtan standards should be, because it might be possible, but
one challenge is difficult to go back.
Yeah. So,
one challenge would be that
he does quote me in that book as saying in the temple. Well, he specifically mentions ISKCON in Salem in South India, where they sing the Mangal Arati in the tune that Srila Prabhupada wanted, which is rare in the whole movement. So what I'm saying, that because I happen to be the guru overseeing the devotees there, and I say it should be done like this, they do it like that. But if you go somewhere else, they might not say, well, you know, whatever. So there's an example of differences of approach, largely according to most followers are not going to think about things even as deeply as you and I are discussing now. And we're really only touching the surface, as you know.
Yes, ma'am.
But most followers want to follow.
Hmm.
They don't, like you're saying, most nowadays are what are they called? Congregation followers. They have their job, they have their families. They don't have they don't have time and maybe not the inclination to get into all kinds of abstruse issues. They want to come to the temple and chant Hare Krishna and hear about Krishna. And someone appeals to them. It's not totally non-philosophical, but it appeals to their heart. And they say, yeah, I want to be part of this. They don't think about all the different issues and this and that. And and actually that's one of the things that the guru does. He's supposed to learn from his guru, learn from Shastra, learn from tradition, and he represents that to his disciples, because you can't individually study all the teachings of the, even to study everything Srila Prabhupada gave. And it's so vast and so deep. So practically the disciples, they rely on the gurus to represent Prabhupada for them. And there are going to be differences in outlook and how to negotiate that. The Catholic Church does a pretty good job, I guess, by having different orders and what do they call that? Different rites. But they've had splits also, haven't they?
Yes, Maharaj. And
but they're not doing too bad in the sense of keeping all different outlooks together.
Yes, Maharaj.
I've heard it said that Srila Prabhupada said we should study the Catholic Church for their organization and everything. That's very much a top-down movement, isn't it? As opposed to the Protestant churches, which are supposed to be me and God, me and Jesus.
Yes.
Right? The original Ritvicism.
Okay. That is true.
So what I'm saying is that I think that the gurus, by their examples, even if the gurus don't, I gave the example of Mahavishnu Maharaj. I hope Mahavishnu Maharaj doesn't mind me giving this example. I think he won't, because he knows that, you know, I have all great love and respect for him. I don't think he's made a very deep philosophical analysis about why he dresses the way he does and his, you could say, zany style. But he does it, and it has its effects. You could say it's not grave enough, but many people seem to appreciate it. So, do you need to make a big philosophical analysis of what should be done and what not should be done?
Yeah.
The house is on fire, so should we?
Yeah, that is one major consideration.
Let's sit down. Let's sit down and discuss it.
Yeah, that is something which is also quite a big issue, especially in the West, because our movement is almost dying out with respect to Westerners. Recently, one devotee wrote, by 2040, 2050, we might be writing the obituary of the last Western devotee in ISKCON, because we are attracting Indians. But now it may not happen. But that is a,
I don't think.
No, but that I think that is.
If you can make projections like that, but I prefer to listen to Lord Chaitanya. Priti vite ace jato nargaradi gram savacha prachahi bai morna. It's time for another Hare Krishna revolution. Anyway, go on saying what you're saying. So, but I don't agree with it.
Okay, thank you.
Satyam eva jayate.
Yes, Maharaj. So two things. You later mentioned the point about sensitivity. So I have been spending, as an instruction of my spiritual master, a lot of time in the West, especially in America, over the last 4 or 5 years. And I try to understand where people are coming from. So I noticed two different things. Yes, there is always the possibility that we become so sensitive that we don't speak the truth. But there is also the other thing, that sometimes there are some aspects about our presentation or about prioritization of our philosophical presentations that alienates people, and then it doesn't let them come to our core teachings. So in that sense, my understanding is sensitization, and is at least we need an awareness of what is going to affect people to what degree. Then after that, we can decide, is this an important enough teaching for me to speak right now at this place to this person? And if it is, then we can speak it. But if it is not, if we are not just aware of it, and something which prevents people from even understanding the core principles of Krishna consciousness because of certain incidental statements, like Prabhupada, that particular conversation which you quoted, Jamadagni, you know, why are you focusing on that? He had so many bodyguards. There is so much other wisdom in the Bhagavatam. Why not focus on that? So my concern is more that if we are not aware of how people perceive us, then we may alienate them by peripheral points and actually be committing violence to them by not giving them even the opportunity to hear the core points. So that, of course, so I would say both dangers are there. One is we become so sensitive that we never speak the core points. But the other is that we become so, you could say, insensitive or unmindful of how our audience is perceiving us, that the peripheral points of our presentation alienate them from the core points and they never get to hear those.
While you were saying that, I was thinking of Srila Prabhupada in America in 1966, giving his classes about how Arjuna should... Krishna was telling Arjuna, you're a fool because you don't want to fight. And this is at the height of the anti-Vietnam War protests. And Srila Prabhupada was talking against illicit sex and against taking drugs. Phew! He got away with it.
Yeah, that is... You know, one thing is, social media has made things much worse now, where any part can be extracted from anywhere and put together. So yeah, that is the challenge. So what you said earlier also, that it's amazing how Prabhupada didn't get too much of a vehement opposition despite his strong statements on many issues.
Well, no, but not only did he not get opposition, but the people who are coming to him were hippies who believed in free sex and drugs and no war. And Srila Prabhupada was strongly against these things, and he still managed to take people out and make devotees. That's really amazing.
Are there some examples which you would like to discuss about how Prabhupada adapted according to his time, place, circumstance, what he learned from Bhaktivedanta Swami Thakur? I think you read that while Prabhupada did some essential changes for some significant changes for not essential changes, but changes that were essential for spreading Krishna consciousness. So can we discuss some examples of that from which we can learn about some principles of change and continuity in the tradition?
Oh, well, that comes, there's a long section on that in the book about Srila Prabhupada's, what one scholar called his religious gradualism.
Okay, gradualism.
Gradualism, yeah, how Srila Prabhupada, and different scholars, Harishari Prabhu quotes one in his Transcendental Diary that he read to Srila Prabhupada, how one scholar had seen different phases in Srila Prabhupada's activities, and Prabhupada appreciated that. And Satsarup Maharaj, in his Prabhupada Leelamrita, he traces out three major phases of Srila Prabhupada's preaching in the West. The initial phase, when it was very small, he was much more accessible. And then it changed as he became a dynamic, well, he was always dynamic, but a worldwide leader. And he couldn't keep in touch with all his disciples. And then the third one, he was revealing, I can't remember exactly, actually. I should have the whole have the whole thing here, but it was he had very big plans for changing the world. That was there even at the beginning. So there were phases in his activities, and definitely in the beginning, he gave initiation. That's one example. He gave initiation very easily. I cite one anecdote of someone who, in San Francisco in 1969 especially, Prabhupada was very liberal in giving initiation, but then later, within quite a short time actually, he became more strict about that. With marriage, in the beginning he was encouraging that, but after some time, without discouraging marriage, he actually used the word disgusted, because he became so fed up of so many marriages breaking up, and he didn't want to be involved in it at all. And then he started emphasizing Varnashram more and more. It's not just for the whole world, but it's for our own devotees also, because so many of them, in the West especially, fail to maintain their vows.
How was Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur's role with respect to arranging marriages or giving initiation?
He had nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with marriage. He was very, in that sense, he was very strict as a sannyasi. He would even, when he was giving initiation to women, he would chant on the beads in the room. The woman would wait outside, and he'd have someone else go and give the beads to her.
Oh, okay.
That I came across recently.
And we
know from OBL Kapoor that when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave Harinam to OBL Kapoor's wife, he did so from behind a screen, which was quite common in those days, that there would be a in an assembly, just like a religious assembly, there'd be a screen between the men and the women.
Okay.
That was a common thing.
Was it then classes also? Or specifically at the time of initiation?
Not that I know of. But at the same time, we don't find that. I never thought of that actually. But we don't hear so much of even women coming to listen to the classes. And there were educated women at that time, but the percentage was much fewer than at the present time.
Okay. So in one sense, we could also say that during Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's time, the social structure was still quite existing, and it was quite conducive for spiritual growth. So he didn't have to intervene in that.
Well, he was more... what nowadays they would call like a male chauvinist than was the current of course, when we say the current of the times, the zeitgeist, it was very confused in India with movements like the Arya Samaj wanting to get back to what they think is the original Vedic course. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was very much against what we would nowadays call feminism. I'll give an example that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was the secretary for the Navadvip Dham Pracharini Sabha at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and even afterward for some time. Now, in one of the Sajjana Toshani magazines, there was a report on the minutes from the meeting of the Navadvip Dham Pracharini Sabha, and which were written by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. There was agreed upon by everyone. And the last one was that, I can't remember exactly the words, but it was something like that. A shabhai kono strigant kono pad nitaparvena. Something like this. I'm saying it in Bengali because no woman can have any pad within this organization. So pad can mean position. It can mean in the same way as having a post, or it can mean just membership also. It wasn't clear to me what it meant. But anyway, you get the gist. It was a point that they all made, no women can have any position, which suggests that that was coming, that women were taking positions in society at that time. They were beginning to do so.
Hmm.
He did have female disciples.
Yeah.
Of course. And he made that Vishnupriya Pali. That was quite an amazing thing for women who couldn't practice bhakti at home. I don't know what kind of, whether it was older women, widows, or even women of childbearing age who left their families. There would be a huge uproar if he took out women from their families when they were still in the role of mothers with young children. So I'm not sure about that. Which kind of women joined at the Vishnupriya Pali. As far as I understand, it was never a very big thing, not that there were very many.
Yes, Maharaj.
And that's closed down now, as you probably know.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, Maharaj. So the point which I was trying to understand is that, you know, like you said, Prabhupada was involved in marriages, and then he decided to not be involved. Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur not much involved in marriages at all. Because
No, not at all.
So I was making the point that maybe that was not so much either male chauvinism, what people might call a male chauvinism or feminism. Maybe it was because it was in India at that time, the devout people, there was to some extent Indian culture was there, and marriages would be arranged. In one sense, when Prabhupada came to the West, his disciples were almost completely taken out of the parent culture. And even in the parent culture, there were not really sound arrangements for marriage. So to some extent, it was more like a social responsibility that Prabhupada had to take, whereas that was not required for Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur. Could it be also like that?
Right. Okay, I get your point. Yeah. But at the same time, I was saying some things about Srila Prabhupada I find very difficult to understand, because Srila Prabhupada, right from the very beginning, it must have been the first marriage he arranged in ISKCON in the West. That was between Mukunda and Janaki.
Yes.
Who were already living together as boyfriend and girlfriend, and he got them initiated. Then just after that, he got them married. But Srila Prabhupada said to Janaki that the wife, she's the head of the home, and she has her jurisdiction within the home. And he had her dress in a sari, and he tied the sari to Mukunda's dhoti and said, now you for 7 days you have to be tied up together. And it seems that Prabhupada, even with his very, very new, maybe they would call themselves the followers, but they really didn't know what it meant to be a disciple, and they really didn't know hardly anything about Krishna consciousness. But he expected them, it seems like that, he expected them to just adopt this culture just like that. And which is why I say that I keep on making the point that later Srila Prabhupada became more and more insistent on Varnashram, seeing that. And he wrote about that. That's one of the most quoted quotes of Srila Prabhupada, that people cannot change their culture overnight. Therefore, we have a policy of engaging the boys and the girls equally. But it seems that in the beginning, and again, we have to be very careful to try to psychoanalyze the mind of an acharya, but it seems that Srila Prabhupada had higher expectations of his earlier disciples than was later seen to that they could live up to that. And that in itself is, you know, it's a very big discussion. And at the same time, Srila Prabhupada said that you were all devotees in your last life and Krishna sent. So there's so many things to consider.
That's true, Maharaj. So just this point about Prabhupada, in one sense, what you said about having particular cultural expectations and at the same time saying that can't change culture overnight.
Well, he wrote that about you can't change the culture overnight. That must have been around 1974 when he was making his Chaitanya Charitamrita commentary.
Yes, Maharaj.
He'd been through a lot in the 8 years or so before he wrote that.
It does seem that he was quite you could say, inclusive in engaging women in various services. Say, for the very idea that a single woman can go out and approach an unfamiliar man to distribute a book. But that itself would have been quite anathema. That would have been quite outrageous in, say, traditional Indian culture, maybe a few centuries, a few decades ago also. So to some extent, is a person's nature, like I say, a woman's nature, is it just determined only by the fact that they have a female body, or is it also determined by the kind of upbringing they have had? The question I'm making is that did Prabhupada, in one sense, accommodate people according to the way they could be engaged in Krishna's service?
One thing we have to understand also, if we're trying to understand Srila Prabhupada's Buddha mission, is that he saw what he was doing in the West as an emergency. He used that word emergency, especially for the in the matter of making Westerners into Brahmanas. He used the term emergency. And he also used the example of when the house is on fire, and he used that for communication. Somehow or other you communicate. But he wanted to preach Krishna consciousness by any means. And the women can distribute books, great. He was into it. But he promoted that. He was very happy with that. Now, there is a significant statement that Srila Prabhupada, Kuladri Prabhu at New Vrindavan said that Srila Prabhupada said to him, and although it's not in the Veda base with a recording of Prabhupada, I think we can take it as authentic. Srila Prabhupada, he spoke to Kuladri about the future and farms. And we know, of course, Srila Prabhupada also said to Rameshwara Swami at the time that millions will join our farms. That Srila Prabhupada saw a very different second phase of the movement from the monastic, let's get out there, we've got to change the world. And then when the world is changed, you can't live all your whole life and develop a society on the basis of being in a constant state of emergency. Srila Prabhupada had a vision for Varnashram. So he definitely engaged the women in various ways at the time, but his basic role model for women was, as you say, according to Indian culture, which is actually according to Shastra, which is to follow Sri Dharma.
Ajay, isn't here analyzing Prabhupada's statements from a particular hermeneutic, where say these are statements for an emergency phase and these are statements for a later phase, and who is going to decide right now whether our movement is in the emergency phase or a later phase?
It should be both. The emergency is still the Western. The Western world is significantly more crazy than it was when Srila Prabhupada was here. Yeah. So that's something which I feel in the whole gender issue, which is splitting ISKCON, it seems to be. I don't think that both sides have come together really and really tried to understand this very deeply. Anyway, I don't want to get into the politics of it all, but we have an emergency situation, but at the same time, we should make a start. By now, we should have well progressed in establishing the stable situation. So a major part of our preaching is showing stable Vaishnav communities, which have their social system, which is hierarchical, and men have their roles to play as Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishyas, and Shudras, and women have their role to play supporting. And everyone chants Hare Krishna together. But there are different social roles. So that's also one kind of preaching, to show an alternative society that works. compared to the madness of the present world, which it doesn't work. It doesn't make people happy, even materially. Economically, it's a mess. And we're supposed to show. So on the one hand, we need men, women, robots. Maybe you can have some program a robot to go and do book distribution. Hey, how about that? Hey, that's a great idea.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm gonna take the patent. I'm gonna take the patent for that one. Maybe the robots can distribute to robots also.
That's
what do you need humans? What do you need humans for anymore? We got robots, right? Anyway, Prabhupada, it's still an emergency. But so we need both things going on side by side. It's not one or the other. We need both things going on side by side. That's what I see. We need to have our farms showing Varnashram Dharma, depending on the land, the cows, and Krishna. But we also need to recruit everyone who can to go out and spread the message. So the social needs and the way we preach to people are going to be different.
Yes, Maharaj. And, you know, in one sense, socially applying spiritual principles, it is a huge challenge. Because if we look at the track record of our movement, probably the biggest disasters have been associated with a social application, whether it's the Gurukuls, which led to the child abuse, which really has a devastating effect. Fortunately, it was not as devastating as it could have been. Then we had like the farm community in New Vrindavan, which just completely went off the rails. So to some extent, trying to...
And there's the well-documented attitudes toward women, which abuse of women. That's also, that's the social thing. Although I must say that pretty much everyone got maltreated. It was pretty rough in some ways. Okay, go on.
In that sense...
Another thing is not just the social disasters, but the guru fall downs. That's also been a major factor in the Hare Krishna implosion in the West.
Implosion. It's a very apt word to describe what has happened. Yeah, that's true. So in one sense, addressing social issues through any means, that is a very complex and in one sense, some situation specific thing. Because although we can say that is a concrete, so Prabhupada had even if we accept that Prabhupada had a very concrete social vision, even Prabhupada did not give the specifics of that vision very. He wanted Varnashram, but how exactly Varnashram is to be implemented? Prabhupada talked, okay, there should be the Brahmana should have these qualities, these people should have these qualities like that. So how to go about implementing that? That is itself a challenge. And in one sense, even for those who are advocating Varnashram, there are quite a few differences of vision about how Varnashram is to be implemented in the movement. Or in our farm communities associated with the movement also.
Well, I'm glad there are different people who have different opinions because I hardly find anyone who's even thinking about it. So if there are different opinions, that means at least there are different people thinking about it.
Oh, okay.
It's just like I came across a statement recently about one of our leaders was saying how we have to be careful that people in the West don't think that we're a cult. And I thought it'd be great if they thought we were a cult. At least they'd be thinking about us. They don't even know we exist.
Okay.
At least if they think we're a cult, they start to think we can start to discuss with them, but they don't even know we exist. So Hare Krishna.
Interesting way of looking at it. Yeah. Yeah, to some extent, we have definitely dropped out of the public awareness in the Western world.
Isn't it amazing? We were so much in the public. We were so prominent, and there weren't that many of us.
Yeah.
We were so dynamic.
That's true. So it's, I think it's from
one,
1980.
One major reason for that was that we used to go on Harinam, and that in itself is massive publicity, because people notice us. They really notice us when we go. A whole bunch of people, all of a sudden you're just in the shopping mall, all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of people with all these different colored dresses and jumping up and down and making these bang, bang, bang. And hey, they're happy. That's really unusual. So it people notice it. And you know, the people come and everyone's taking photos and nowadays videos and doing selfies and all that kind of thing. So people definitely noticed us, and the book distribution, people noticed us. So that's good advertisement, just to do the basic core activities of preaching, public Harinam and book distribution. And of course, festivals and prasad distribution, and there are so many things to do, TV preaching, but these two things are really, they really notice us.
Yeah, it almost seems as if as our movement went down in the West, it started growing in India. Because even during Prabhupada's times, there are a lot of people who became life members, but not many became committed followers.
Yeah, but I tell you what, just at the time Prabhupada was leaving was a time when Prabhupada was just getting noticed by prominent people, just like your Nathji, Srinathji, and the people like that, really prominent people. And in the government, people would, if Prabhupada had stayed a few more years, he would have been heralded. Big people were coming to him, and they were just getting convinced. The opening of the Vrindavan temple, that was a major thing. And then the Bombay temple was about to be opened, and people were visiting, and they're seeing there's this fabulous temple coming up. But they're even more struck. You know, that was in the story of your Mahaprabhu. He often told that story. It really fascinated educated Indians like himself who were not interested in religion or Hinduism. They were just amazed by seeing these Western people living and not living Krishna consciousness and knowing the philosophy. And it really had an impression, and a good class of people were coming, and they continued to come actually even after. But one disaster happened. Even in Vrindavan, there are so many people like Guptas and merchants. They were coming to Kirtanananda for initiation. Vrindavan. This is again, it's unpleasant history. But if Kirtanananda, if he had stayed what he seemed, people had faith in him and they were becoming his disciples, and there was big people were coming to him, and the movement would have been different. Again, the guru fall down thing, it did have its effect in India also, especially. It's a complex history, but how do we get to that?
I was saying that it's almost it was as if as our movement went down in the West, it started growing in India. So you're saying in one sense, the momentum had been set up by Prabhupada's presence, and then momentum was built.
Indian devotees were beginning to join as brahmacharis also, which had hardly happened previously. They were joining in numbers.
Yes, Maharaj. It seems...
There were so many in Mayapur. I was in Mayapur when Srila Prabhupada passed away. And... there were so many young Bengali brahmacharis, and then they were initiated by, first batch was initiated by Bhavananda, and then, like this.
Yes, Maharaj. So the overall point I was making is that it seems in India, our movement is growing. Of course, we could grow much, much more, but it is growing significantly. No?
Yeah. It's an Indian headship.
Okay. Indian headship. Yeah, sorry. So in one sense, we can say that there are some things which we are doing right because of which we are growing, if we can say phalena parichayate as a criteria. And so can we also say that the cultural context make a big difference?
Oh, of course, yeah. And people, people are born in India for a reason, right? They have a background piety, inclination toward Krishna consciousness. But then Bharata Bhumite Hoila Manusha Janma Ja Janma Shatam Kari Paro Karo Paro Upaka. Prabhupada quoted this so many times. He said he wanted Indians. Now you Indians go and save the West.
Yes, Maharaj.
And even I was recently, there was one conversation with Srila Prabhupada in Tehran, and he met some Indians for the first time. And he was preaching to them, you should be, you're India. He quoted this verse, you should become gurus. People he saw for the first time, amazing.
It's almost like he was doing what Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur did with him in the first meeting.
Right, yeah.
Yes, Maharaj. So Maharaj, I was making this...
I like you said, there's the Hare Krishna implosion in the West, but I think it can come up, and we have to look to India.
Yes, Maharaj.
The Indians spread Krishna consciousness around the world again.
Yes, Maharaj. So the point I was trying to make through this is could it be that the way we are presenting Krishna consciousness, it appeals to people who have grown up in a hierarchical society largely. India still is hierarchical, although it's changing. But as society becomes less and less hierarchical, the way we present Krishna consciousness stops resonating with people. It starts... So although we can say that Prabhupada approached people and he spoke very strongly and people accepted at that time like four regulative principles and chanting, but to some extent, even Prabhupada's disciples at those times, the people who came, they also had grown up at least to some extent in the hierarchical society. The post-World War, they just had experience with bad authorities.
That's true. They
but
had experience
now, today, 2010, yeah. 2020, there is, leave alone bad authority, there is no authority practically speaking.
So I don't think so. People like to think like that, but actually there is. Yeah, go on.
No, of course. I mean, if you can say left liberal, the leftists, they are themselves authorities and they do moral policing and canceling of others.
Yeah.
So in principle, authority can never be rejected. Some authority will be there, of course. Mm. But the point I was making is that a hierarchical presentation of Krishna consciousness appeals to people who have grown up in a hierarchical culture. And when the culture itself becomes highly egalitarian, then the hierarchy itself jars people with so many negative memories and negative stimuli that it alienates them. So
yeah, but it may be that people and they're looking for direction because that could have the effect also if people there's no one to lead them, and then we have the only he could lead them was the title of one of the volumes of the Prabhupada Lilamrita. The effect could have the effect of someone. And that happens socially also. We see that people become less and more and more egalitarian, and then they want a big leader. It swings, doesn't it? It's like the swing between materialism and romanticism, and then you have egalitarianism and liberalism, and then people want a strong leader who can take charge and lead the way, and it's like a swing goes on. But Krishna consciousness has to be hierarchical because you have to have gurus, and if there's an organization, there has to be a hierarchy, and God's at the top.
Of course. So usually toward the end, I try to summarize, if I can do that in a couple of minutes.
Okay, we were all over the place, thanks to me.
Okay, no, it is a difficult subject. So broadly, we try to discuss the topic of change and continuity in the Gaudiya tradition. With the focus on Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur. And then so you read from your article.
Which I only got about 35% of the way through.
Yes, Maharaj. So you discussed the point that in that article that there can be, the first point you mentioned that this is not an abstract discussion because it matters in today's world. Because how are we going to go ahead? And we have this immense responsibility of carrying on the mission of these great acharyas who practically changed the course of world history, world religious history at least. So we try to draw some guidelines, and you mentioned that there is no, that in personalities, in outlooks, there can be difference in acharyas. And then I mentioned that, so Prabhupada didn't change in the essential message, but there was a difference. And then with respect to, so I discussed like social issues, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was against child marriage, but Prabhupada had slightly different stand. So then I mentioned, can we say that social stands are a little more contextual according to Acharya? So you said Prabhupada also had a very concrete social vision.
Even with Bhaktivinoda, I mean, I should qualify that. At least superficially, he seemed to be against child marriage.
Okay, go on.
So
then you mentioned that because Prabhupada is a founder Acharya and he did seem to have a concrete social vision. So we cannot simply separate like that. That doesn't mean we freeze our moment in time. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we neglect Prabhupada's guidelines. We have to have that balance between fidelity and relevance. And then we discussed 2-3 issues. One issue which kept coming up was feminism. And the other issue was, of course, with respect to...
I was mostly using feminism to demonstrate various points.
The point which I think you were mentioning using feminism to discuss the point that how the world has radically changed and there is a lot of craziness in the Western world now. So Prabhupada was able to speak strongly and still he was able to reach to a lot of people. But in today's world, we have the danger of becoming hypersensitive and not speaking our message also. But at the same time, so we discussed this point of when we are following Prabhupada, at one level, different devotees will do different things. And ultimately, it may come down to the Guru Vachan. So something like the Catholic Church has got orders. But by our discussions like this, we can try to come to some broad principles. And one principle which you tried to discuss was that with respect to Prabhupada wanting, there's a first phase of emergency, second phase of more of return to the tradition of an ashram. So we can say that right now in our movement, both phases are still there. So both may need to go in parallel. And to some extent, in the West, it's more of an emergency mode. Whereas in India, our movement is flourishing. And you mentioned that Prabhupada set up the momentum and the next generations have built on that. And that's how, in one sense, it's the responsibility of India and Indians to show the way for the rest of the world to become Krishna conscious. Of course, there are many other points. But is there anything concluding you would like to say, Maharaj?
Many things, but I won't because I want to chant Gayatri and go to Arati.
Okay, Maharaj. Thank you very much for your sharing your wisdom and sparing your time, Maharaj. I look forward to your association again in future. Then we can
okay, Jai.
Further. Thank you.
Hari Hari Bol.